hitting a target like this, especially if they're partnered, an hour goes really fast.
We talk about our electronic warfare capabilities and our cyber capabilities, but you really don't know how they're going to perform until you actually test them against a real opponent.
The big thing we learned there is you can't be stationary. You got to be moving. We call it bucket speed. You don't fly slower than 60 knots anywhere.
How did we grow this capability, right? And it really came out of, you know, the fiasco of Desert One and Operation Eagle Claw.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point Class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, we're discussing the raid conducted by U.S. forces along with law enforcement personnel to capture Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The operation triggered no shortage of public discussion, much of it about the political context, the geopolitical and strategic implications, and questions of policy and law. But this conversation examines it strictly as a military operation. What lessons can we learn from its planning and conduct, for example? And how do the capabilities that made the operation successful apply in a large-scale conflict? I'm joined in this episode by two guests who have extensive military experience that makes them exceptionally well-suited to explore these questions. Liam Collins is a retired U.S. Army colonel who spent much of his career in special operations units, including deployments around the world. And Jimmy Blackman, also a retired colonel, is a veteran helicopter pilot who spent years deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan and participating in missions aimed at high-value targets. Before we get to the discussion, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point Class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Liam Collins and Jimmy Blackman. Liam and Jimmy, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I guess maybe to start, we're going to talk about, I invited you on because I want to talk about this recent military operation in Venezuela that we saw, Operation Absolute Resolve. I want to talk about it specifically from a military operational perspective. I'll get more into that. But before we do, you know, there's a reason that I asked the two of you to come on and have this discussion. So if you could kind of introduce yourself to listeners, just give us a few seconds about, you know, your military backgrounds.
Yeah, Jimmy, why don't you go first?
I'm Jimmy Blackman, retired Army colonel, spent 30 years in the Army and aviation as an officer. I was enlisted prior to that, but I spent the majority of my career in the 101st Airborne Division. I went from major through colonel there, commanded a squadron, air cavalry squadron, and a brigade in the 101st, and 6 out of 12 years in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Balkans, and a close friend of Liam Collins for over 30 years.
And Liam?
Yeah, so I'm Liam, retired Special Forces Colonel. Spent some time in Afghanistan, Iraq, Bosnia, South America, and other operational areas. And then was a founding director of the Modern War Institute at West Point. So it's always good to be back and see the Modern War Institute.
Yeah, you've been on before, so listeners will regular listeners will be familiar with your voice. So, as I mentioned, I invited you on to talk about the operation last weekend that we saw in which Venezuelan president, now former Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, was captured and brought to the U.S. To face charges for drug trafficking. And a lot of the public discussion has quite naturally sort of focused on the politics, the geopolitics, the questions of law, international law involved in this. And those conversations are going to continue and they should continue. But I also think there's scope for a discussion from a purely kind of military operational perspective. As you both know, you know, Liam, especially as MWI's founding director, MWI sort of exists to do this, to sort of try to further our understanding of modern warfare and all of its complexities. And I think that, you know, this operation, when you look at it, it is frankly one of a kind. There's nothing like it in modern military history. And if you go back even further in military history, sure, there are large-scale raids, but the technology is so fundamentally different. So I think it's worth examining to see if there are lessons from it that can help us kind of better understand, you know, various facets of modern warfare. I have sort of a number of observations that that I want to get each of your thoughts on. But first, you know, as soon as news of this operation broke, you guys maybe experienced the same thing. My phone pretty much blew up. A lot of people in my professional network were, you know, texting and sending emails, messaging. They were talking about this because it was, you know, this sort of major event. And because it was, you know, in the opening minutes after we all heard what had happened, I don't think anybody had enough time to sort of develop these full and cohesive, you know, frameworks for conceptualizing the operation. So it really was kind of their instinctive initial responses. It was things like, you know, wow, what an impressive tactical and operational display. You know, it's incredible that 150 aircraft went out, 150 aircraft came back, given, you know, the realities of modern air defenses. So I guess to kick us off, Jimmy, maybe we'll start with you. I wonder if you can kind of, you know, if you transport yourself back to last Saturday when you first heard news of this operation, what were this sort of first couple of things that came to mind for you?
It's interesting because it's so prominent in my mind because it was, wow, this has been planned for a long time. And they kept it quiet. That's not always so easy when, you know, I mean, I've lived inside the Beltway multiple times. There's no such thing as a secret. And so I was really impressed that they were able to keep it really, you know, quiet. You know, we know intel drives maneuver. They've been collecting patterns of life for quite some time, human on the ground. And then, of course, the planning, the rehearsing, this has been planned for a significant amount of time.
It wasn't a target of opportunity, right?
No.
And Liam?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things is, I don't think it was, you know, from a military perspective, the operation itself wasn't a surprise in terms of, right, we have this capability. I mean, we've executed, you know, on some level, hundreds, thousands of times. Each one is unique. This obviously is unique because it's going in, you know, into a foreign nation. But, you know, it's not that dissimilar from Operation Neptune Spear to get bin Laden in Pakistan, you know, more than a decade ago. And so I guess I wasn't that surprised by the military aspects of the operation.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because that is, I think, the first kind of frame of reference that we start to look at this through. Because that was the last time we did something big like this, right? A joint, you know, effort to accomplish prosecute a high value target. When during that operation, we sent two aircraft out, one came back, right? So, and that just happens. Even if you don't take, you know, fire from the ground or something, accidents can happen. So the fact that there were so many moving pieces to this and really nothing bad came happen. One aircraft, I believe, was hit. There were no US fatalities. I guess, am I right to be as kind of shocked by that as I was?
I thought bread and butter. I mean, you know, it's no secret who did it now. And it's a core mission for them. But if you do have time and you have the resources and the ability to really collect like they did, then yeah, I'm with Liam that it was no surprise. I mean, you know, once, you know, it's the Mike Tyson, once, you know, the plan goes to hell once you get hit in the nose. But fortunately on this thing, they seem to have been able to mitigate, you know, the risk pretty well. But not a surprise that it was a huge success to me.
Yeah, I would add though, I mean, it is, I mean, even in training, right, you might land hard, lose a wheel, right? Things happen. And so, yeah, the fact that you were able to have that many assets return, if that is actually the case, that there really was nothing significant, that is pretty amazing with that many assets involved. If you have that many assets involved in a training mission, you might have something mechanical just go down with a helicopter that forces it to, that you have to leave it behind, that had nothing to do with the operation itself other than just it when it's one of those mechanical things.
Yeah. You know, we had, it's one of the first things that struck out to me was that you had Chinooks involved, you had Blackhawks involved, you had Apaches involved, you had fixed wing aircraft of all shapes and sizes involved from all services. You had Marine Corps, Air Force, and Navy fixed wing aircraft. You know, Jimmy, you've been involved in some pretty significant operations as an aviator in Iraq, for instance. You didn't mention this in your brief bio that you gave us, but you were involved in the operations to capture the number two and the number three in the famous Iraqi deck of cards early in the Iraq War. You know, we have another podcast series called The Spear, which is a sort of one-on-one discussions about the combat experience. And we've had a number of aviators on there, including Apache pilots. And in the context of Iraq or Afghanistan, that usually means two gunships overhead, providing overwatch for a ground element. For a larger operation like this, when you have that many aircraft, what are some of the just coordination challenges that you have?
Well, again, when you're planning this, thinking about, I don't know anything inside information on what the package looked like, but you're going to decide, you know, based on patterns of life, where the most opportune place to hit the guy is, and they decided on the compound. Then it's about, you know, you got Rangers involved with blocking positions. You've got the assault force, obviously, with Delta. So, you know, going through what, you know, how you're going to deliver them. Is it going to be a pod blast on Little Birds? Is it going to be fast rope out of a CH-47? There's just a lot of different things that go into the planning process to figure out the best way to assault the objective. And then within that, I mean, all of those aircraft that were actually actions on the objective, they're used to working together. And you tailor packages. When we were in Afghanistan, for example, kind of the go-to package for a strike force was, you know, two Chinooks would carry the main body, and you would have four UH-60s that would deliver the blocking force to isolate the objective. And those working together, I mean, you just, they're, you know, rudimentary ways of how they work together that are standard operating procedures. Then everything above that's the stack. And of course, that's, you know, the all of your fixed wing stuff. And we do coordinating altitudes. We, you know, vertically divide the airspace by what type of aircraft it is. But it's, you know, again, it's something you train and you're used to working together. And we have control measures that allow us to, you know, divide the airspace and understand who should be where, when. Then it just comes down to disciplined execution.
Liam, you spent a large portion of your career in the special operations community. This was obviously a special operations task force package. You know, one of the first things I thought was, wow, this is very impressive. And I heard, you know, the day after, I think on CNN, Wesley Clark, retired General Wesley Clark, was on and saying, you know, if I'm in Moscow or I'm in Beijing, I'm looking at that and saying, we can't do that. And I think that that's probably true. If Russia could do that, you know, the war in Ukraine would have ended very differently, very early in February 2022, rather than having a long column stalled trying to get to Kiev, they would have done something like this. Now, the flip side of that is, you know, this argument that SOF is a very, very, very capable hammer. And the risk is that makes everything look like a nail. And I don't want to get into questions of policy, but I wonder if, you know, I guess if you had any particular views on, you know, the portability of this sort of capability outside of the SOF enterprise, you know, into conventional units, even some of our most elite conventional units, the 173rd Airborne, the 82nd Airborne Division.
I mean, it's like anything. I mean, the SOF is oftentimes the leading edge of something, and then it becomes more commonplace and diffuses across the military. Again, something like this, that's a capability just in terms of the level of the air, right? You got aircraft most, again, I don't have any inside information. I'm just going what I read off of open source, but right, these are aircraft that are, you know, they're more enhanced than the typical aircraft, right? The pilots have way more hours in training, right? So you can't do that. You just got to look at what pieces of the operation can do this. But I think it's important to take a step back and understand, how did we grow this capability, right? And it really came out of, you know, the fiasco of Desert One and Operation Eagle Claw and the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986 that really reformed our Department of Defense. And then really we built this capability that you really saw executed with Operation Neptune Spear, you know, to get Bin Laden, and then the most recent operation, perfect that off of, you know, iteration after iteration after iteration in Afghanistan and Iraq, right? It was built before that, but that was where it was really perfected and perfecting, you know, what we developed into the find, fix, finish, exploit, analyze cycle that was executed here. And so we couldn't have done this, you know, however many years ago that we could do with perfection now. But it really came from, you know, not just training built some capability, but it was the wartime environment where you can really refine this in a way that you just cannot do even at the combat training centers, right? You just can't replicate in the same way that we could in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so that's important to note when you think, when you're looking at the combat going on now, what are adversaries or potential adversaries developing through iteration after iteration that we just can't do in training?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it is one of the things that I thought about. You know, there was a time, especially at the height of the war in Afghanistan, where, right, the famous night raids, we were doing so many of these, on, you know, at a time when you know, the Special Operations Task Forces were, because they had gotten that find, fix, finish, exploit, analyze cycle down pat, we were often launching the same teams at multiple targets a night based on the intelligence that we're gathering from the first target. When you're doing that every night, day in, day out for, you know, this was for years, you do get pretty good at it. We're not doing that day in and day out now. So how do you replace that sort of muscle memory that's gained operationally with training when you can't ever fully replicate the realities of combat operations like this?
Yeah, I would say, you know, when you look at an operation like this, I think people focus on the ground, right? The sexy part in, you know, of grabbing someone or shooting someone. But really, the hardest part really is the intelligence that goes behind it, right? Finding the person. That's the hardest thing to do. And then fixing them. When we mean fixing, right, identifying that person with a reasonable degree of certainty that they'll be there when you go there, right? In terms of like the Bin Laden raid, it was maybe 40%, 50%. They felt maybe he'll be there, but it's our best shot. This, right, they were waiting until they had the conditions were right and they were with, you know, pretty darn certain he was going to be there. That to me is the hardest part. The next hardest part is guys like Jimmy that are flying blacked out, like nap of the earth, or especially if you're flying over the ocean, like, and it's 0% illumination under night vision goggles. I can't imagine anything harder than that. That's probably the hardest thing to do. I always said I got the easy job. Someone's got to find him. Jimmy's got to fly me there and fly me back. All I got to do is just do the simple part, you know. But the funny thing is that the intelligence people think they have the easy job, and then Jimmy and I have the hard job, and Jimmy's probably thinking he's got the easiest job, and I and the intelligence person have the hardest part. But that, I think it's important to understand it's the complexity of that when you're talking about, hey, do other nations have this capability? No one has the intelligence capability that we have. No one has the pilots we have. You could buy the aircraft. Jeff Bezos could buy the aircraft. He couldn't buy the pilots, right? You can't buy that. And then you couldn't buy that force that's capable of executing that operation.
You make a good point. I want to hit a couple of things here. One is we could regress, right? Like, necessity is the mother of all invention. And you're right. You can't replicate combat. I remember when Tom Drew was the task force commander at the time in Iraq with 160th. And we decided to do daytime vehicle interdiction. That is about as high risk as anything we do, man. That is, I mean, you can't drive a five penny nail up your rear end with a sledgehammer. It is high risk, but we've never done that.
But it depends on the environment, right? Because we've done it in Bosnia, or we've done it in training. Yeah. It depends on the threat.
The mountain environment. Right. Yeah, it's different. But it's the point being, we did that because we had to do it, and soon developed a capability that no one in the world could dream of doing, right? What you were talking about, banging multiple targets. We started hitting 2 to 3 targets per night at the beginning, right? And then we realized...
No, it was lucky if we had one.
But soon we're hitting 25 to 30 and dynamically retasking on the objective. Again, hadn't done that before because we were risk averse. It was, you know, very deliberate planning to go do an op. And soon, you know, you hit a target and they're running out the windows, diving, you know, running off, but you get a laptop, you get some more intel. That strike force package could dynamically retask and go hit another target. Training that is near impossible. But if we step way back from that, the other point I want to make is, you know, how can these other nations not doing it? Having served in the conventional force, you know, I lived through sequestration where I'm trying to defend 7.62 ammo to go shoot a range, man. I mean, and we have the biggest economy on the planet. It costs a lot of money to train this capability. So our economy drives our ability to build this military that is as capable as it is. And most nations couldn't dream of being able to throw that type of, you know, capital at the military to train to that level.
You know, it's Liam had mentioned, you know, how challenging it is to fly blackout, you know, in new environments. For instance, if you, you know, if you've looked at the terrain around Caracas, if you look at the terrain in Venezuela, it's not easy to fly low, I would imagine. Liam, I don't know if you remember, we did a trip once. Well, on the way to Ukraine, we spent a couple of days at JMRC. It was one of the first times that Ukrainians had come and were training at JMRC. And so we got to go observe it. And we flew around the training area in a helicopter. And the pilot was very well trained, flew us, you know, nap of the earth. And it's the only time I've ever done that. I've been in plenty of helicopters, but it's the only time I had flown that low. And the sensation, I kept picking my feet up because I felt like they were going to brush the trees, you know, right below me. That's how there's this sort of like psychological effect for somebody who's not accustomed to that. Jimmy, can you kind of describe what, you know, what some of those challenges are, you know, and, you know, maybe give listeners a sense of, you know, what you're experiencing when you are flying so low, so fast, you know, under blackout conditions, sometimes in an operation like this?
Yeah. Well, you know, the ocean is, as Liam depicted it, it's just black. You can't see anything. So you're flying a radar altimeter. You just got to trust your
instinct. And you don't even have a horizon to look at.
Nothing. And the desert's not much different, though. I mean, Anbar province, there is no ambient light out there. And so, and the problem with the desert is it's rolling, right? You got dunes and everything else. And so, again, you're trusting your instruments. You're flying a radar altimeter when you're doing that. But it is even very seasoned guys. I remember, you know, April 2003, when we went into Iraq, I mean, we had Chief Warrant Officer Fours that had thousands of hours that were saying, hey, I can't do a desert landing at night under goggles. Like, you bust me back. I'm like, I don't want on the controls because you completely brown out. That sand comes up and it just, it hits, you know, the air in front of you and your goggles go blind. So it's just a trusted planet type of thing. And again, that goes back to, if you can't replicate that in training, then you start to, those skill sets start to diminish over time. And so realistic training scenarios are, you know, critical for, you know, our pilots.
You know, anybody who's spent any time in the woods with a compass knows how easy it is to think, no, I know better. This compass must be wrong, and to not trust your instruments. So I imagine that takes just hours and hours and hours in the cockpit of gaining confidence in those instruments to know that your instincts are telling you to pull up or push down or turn right or left, but the instruments are telling you, nope, don't do that. Stay the course.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, as you know, because of, you know, the budget, we started becoming more and more reliant on technology, and they stopped teaching, flying using just a map in flight school. And I loved it when I was in Jalalabad in 2008 to 10, we would do a mission in, you know, Northern Kunar province, Nuristan, and we'd start back. I'd be flying with some young warrant officer, and I just pulled the circuit breaker and turn all the, make the cockpit go black and go, okay, man, somebody just shot us. We lost everything. Get me home. And people panic because.
Yes. Or just the enemy's capability to jam things, right? I mean, electronic warfare and other capabilities. I mean, you've got to be able to, I mean, it's at the ground level too. I mean, people can't navigate like they used to because they're relying on instruments and technology to do that. But when technology fails, then you're really in trouble.
Yep.
What about, you know, you both have operational experience in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, going places where, you know, time on target matters. You start to get this, right, spidey sense of, hey, we've been here a long time. I don't know, it hasn't been publicly reported, but from the reports that we've seen, you know, the operation probably took between 2 and 3 hours. They were the force was probably on the ground for around an hour. That's not very long. But when you think in the context of a current operational theater like Ukraine, spending an hour in any place is it's suicide, because, you know, this, the proliferation of sensors and the condensed kill chain, you know, the targeting process that used to take days or hours is now minutes or less. I guess, do you have any thoughts on that? You know, how much that sort of time on target matters and how that's changing compared to, say, when, you know, both of your experience in places like Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, you want to keep that obviously at a minimum. I mean, 30 minutes, probably not much more. I mean, you've got to, if that's the mission, you got to assume the risk to stay longer. I mean, of course, I mean, as most listeners will know, you don't have to go, you go back to Mogadishu in 1993, and that's against a, you know, you would not call a sophisticated opponent with advanced technology, and they were on the ground too long, right? And it cost. So you just think technology 30 years later. You want to keep it under 30 minutes, you know, 15 is ideal, but if the mission is the mission, that's what, you know, we sign up and assume the risk for. And it's not just a risk on the target, someone coming to the target, but it's the exfiltration, which a lot of people don't think about. You've incurred that additional risk. And then also, especially if you're pushing till daylight as you're flying out of there, now you might have additional capabilities engaging you on the way out.
I don't know. I mean, like Liam said, I mean, obviously, you know, minimum exposure is, you know, the risk curve goes up the longer you're there, but an hour flies. It really does. I mean, it goes fast. You're talking about, you know, in the case of this mission, the best of the best in every position that executed this thing, from the pilots to the ground force, to the blocking, to everything. In the conventional side, I'll just say as a, you know, point of reference, hitting a target like this, especially if they're partnered, an hour goes really fast. And that also changes everything on the air side, because now we've got, you know, especially if you're using little birds, you got station time problems. And so it's, you know, how long can I be here? How long can I loiter? The other thing, Liam mentioned Mogadishu, and, you know, that was one of the biggest learning experiences on the air side that we've ever had. And that was we learned some hard lessons about flying in a mountain environment. And you were talking to NOE. The big thing we learned there is you can't be stationary. You got to be moving. We call it bucket speed. You don't fly slower than 60 knots anywhere, and you sure don't hover unless, you know, they're fast roping or whatever, you know, to get in or the extraction point. Otherwise, everything's moving all the time. And so we learned a lot of lessons from that we applied in Iraq, and your exposure time when you're up high versus when you're down low. I mean, we were flying under 35 foot high power lines in Iraq for the first 4 or 5 years at 80, 90 knots. Because, you know, it's hard to hit a moving target that's low and you only have so much exposure time to it.
It is one of the things that, that I thought about, you know, when you mentioned Black Hawk Down, the Black Hawk Down incident in Mogadishu in 1993 is, you know, it wasn't a well-armed force in Somalia, but they had RPGs, and RPGs can do a lot of damage to a helicopter. And guess what they have in Venezuela? Narco traffickers that have RPGs. And so a lucky shot, even from an RPG, the fact that nothing like that happened, I guess it still sort of just surprises me. Besides, you know, criminal elements, they might have RPGs or heavy machine guns that they're firing at these helicopters. Venezuela also had, you know, I think it was 12 S-300 air defense systems, a number of mid-range point defense systems. You know, Maduro was even, you know, sort of tauntingly mentioning all of the man pads that they had distributed around Venezuela, including around Caracas. None of those came into effect. And I guess I wonder, both of you, from your different perspectives and based on your combat experience, what sort of thoughts you had. You know, we in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, outside of the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003, we had total air supremacy. And even then, we were able to dominate the Iraqi air defenses and neutralize them pretty quickly. I guess, you know, this is an environment where we were able to do that, but these were not the most advanced Russian systems. They were some of the most advanced Chinese radars. And I think Beijing probably has some questions to answer to its clients that it's exported some of these out to, that they were not brought into the fight. But I wonder if either of you have any thoughts on kind of the air defense element of this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's something we, you know, worry about all the time when you're going in, going out. In some ways, I think the U.S., we worry about it almost too much in terms of, right, you don't always need a 30-day air war before you go in. I mean, when Azerbaijan, if they would have taken a 30-day air war to get ready to go into Armenia or Nagorno-Karabakh in 2020, the war would have been over diplomatically before they started it. But it is a valid threat. But I think this showed, right, we talk about our electronic warfare capabilities and our cyber capabilities, but you really don't know how they're going to perform until you actually test them against a real opponent. And that's not something you can do in training. And I think this showed that those capabilities worked and we were able to disable those systems, whatever, whether that's people or the systems themselves, but we were able to disarm or disable those and allow the operation to go through. And I think that doesn't get enough credit for how important that was to the operation.
Yeah, Liam makes a good point that, you know, for my entire career, we really focused on air defense and our countermeasures. And quite frankly, we just had to trust that the system worked because you can't train it, whether it's lasers, whether it's IR, whatever, you know, you just have to trust that the technology works. And, you know, it certainly tested, you know, by the companies making it, but never in my career did we ever use that. But, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, we were more concerned with RPGs and I don't like Dishkas, by the way. I've been shot at by them quite a few times. It's a big boom. And it's a 14.7 millimeter bullet. But anyway, you know, with that, all you can do is how you fly, you know, your routes to the target, how fast you're flying, what altitude you're flying, keep varying it up and don't give them a lucrative opportunity to really, you know, hone in on you. But that worried us more than anything sophisticated. Even, and you know, in Anbar in 2003, I mean, I did an op down there where we found hundreds of caches, and there were SA-8s, I mean, stacked up like cordwood everywhere. Never got shot at by one. My unit did not. And it was always, you know, all the pilots that were killed or wounded and all the airplanes shot at was generally small arms firing RPGs.
Yeah. And looking at Russia's invasion in 2022 of Ukraine, that first day, Russia pretty much disabled or was able to bypass all of the Ukrainian kind of standing air defense systems. And it was actual man pads that took, you know, from visual seeing that took down the helicopters on the raid to Hostomel.
You know, I think the one of the things I mentioned to you before we were recording, you know, that there was an early video from a witness in Caracas that was spreading around social media of U.S. helicopters sort of flying low over the city. And the first thing I thought of was how many drones there would be in the sky if those are Russian aircraft over the front lines in Ukraine, for instance. Jimmy, you've flown in places where, you know, where that now would be a very different sort of operation, a very different challenge, given the number of drones, small drones that there are in operational theaters now. How is that changing kind of in your opinion, I think, the aviation perspective on operations like this?
Yeah. So, you know, going into Iraq 2003, the only thing we were worried about were unlit towers and power lines, right? I mean, that was it. Kites would be up everywhere in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Can't tell you how many kites we've taken out, how many ducks we've taken out. But the drones are a game changer. Yeah. I mean, you flood the sky. I think it should be noted, you know, you can shoot a BB gun through a helicopter. I mean, it's honeycomb. It doesn't take much to take it out, especially you hit the tail rotor with something and you're in trouble. And so, you know, a small, you know, commercially bought drone at 100 miles an hour into a helicopter, and you got a significant issue. You're probably crashing. And so how doctrinally, you know, Fort Rucker's looking at this and how they're thinking about, you know, future warfare and considerations for this, I don't know. I absolutely am unplugged, but it is a definite concern.
Liam, you've mentioned the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh war. You've been there on a number of trips to conduct research about the war. That was the war that really kicked off this sort of kind of rejuvenated focus, emphasis, certainly within the Army, the U.S. Army, on the air-ground littoral, right? This space where the ground meets the air, the low altitude, the area that is being flooded with these groups one and two, maybe group three drones. I wonder if, you know, if you put yourself kind of in the shoes of a planner for an operation like that, how do you approach that, an operation like this, differently now in the drone age than you would have, say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'd like to have better counter drone technology than we probably have. You know, technology is not the solution to everything, but I don't think we, you know, probably are where we need to be in terms of that. But yeah, I mean, it really affects where you're thinking. I kind of call it, I don't think it's a doctrinal term, but I call it the canopy level because I don't have a better name for it, but that kind of that low level. But yeah, you've really got to think about, okay, countering theirs, what else is going to be in that space? And in some ways, I always used to joke, but I was serious, you know, big sky, little bullet theory, right? I mean, the likelihood of getting hit by something sometimes, you know, a stray thing is pretty low. But when you could put up hundreds of drones into an area, and we know these helicopters, where they inserted something. So how much time do you have before somebody puts a whole fleet up in the air for the exfil? Or maybe you got to look at, you know, kind of the combined exfil, and you're going to exfil from somewhere different, going back kind of older school, and you're going to have to do a ground movement to a different space because they're expecting you there.
So you both have, you know, we listeners will have a pretty good understanding of your professional experiences and your role in various combat operations. You know, Jimmy as an aviator, Liam as an operator on the ground. For a mission like this, I know that, you know, these are few and far between. So I'm not suggesting that each of you have participated in things of this scale, but if you imagine that you did, at what point during the presumably months long planning process do those various elements come together and really get to know each other? Because anytime you're doing something jointly, there's friction. You expand that to an interagency because there's a law enforcement component to this, certainly. There's friction. So at what point of that planning and rehearsals process do you kind of all come together and start to get comfortable that, hey, this is what I'm doing when you're doing this and vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing is we don't do it for the first time here. I mean, we did it for training. I mean, before 9/11, right, we didn't expect to go to combat. I honestly, I didn't think I was ever going to go to combat in my military career. And then, but before 9/11, we trained hard. We knew all the pilots. I knew all the Jimmies, right? They knew us. So we knew each other intimately before then. So it wasn't the first time we had ever gotten together. We had done tough, realistic training before that. And so when the time came and we knew the mission, in this case, Afghanistan, a very complex, you know, similar type of mission profile, we were able to execute it without much prep. We didn't have the luxury of time to wait for the perfect day to execute this. It was kind of go and do it. And so we had minimal rehearsals, but you don't need a lot of time to rehearse if you've practiced it and done that training in combat. The same thing, right? Doing a halo jump into combat, it was first time we had done one in probably since Vietnam, but it was, we had executed a similar mission profile only weeks before because we were getting ready for what we could do. So I don't think, yeah, sure, the intel people may be a little different, but you know, there is some history we can base on that. Yeah, I don't think we're beyond that yet. But I think you did that from repeated training, and I knew all the pilots before 9/11.
Yeah, I agree. It all comes down to training. It's the only thing I would say that's different is, you know, when we were in Iraq and Afghanistan and doing it all the time, we had kind of standard packages, and we had SOPs and kind of knew how it was going to go. You'd tweak something here, tweak something there. But when it came down to, you know, what's the size of the assault force, how many blocking positions, whatever, I mean, we knew what we were going to do. And the familiarity like that, again, I remember Iraq, 2003, we had every one of our aviation cavalry troop commanders, aviators, go on a deliberate op with a ground force, kicking a door. Because we wanted them to build those relationships and feel what it was like on the ground so they could anticipate and think. And so those shared experiences like that really helps you to I know what he's going to ask for before he asks. So I'm just going to feed him ahead of time, right? I've got a bird's eye perspective of the objective. I'm in a Kiowa. I'm 50 feet above the ground, and you know, I can see things, and I know what he wants to know. That all comes from training. And the relationships are invaluable.
And you know, you only get so much out of training, but it's more of just pushing your thinking and everything else. Again, kind of prior to 9/11, right? The MH-47s were really viewed as almost like a bus driver, right? Or a taxi, right? They weren't a combat aircraft. That's kind of how they were viewed, right? And then all of a sudden 9/11 happened, and the only aircraft that had the leg to transport us was the MH-57s, right? And so this wasn't something that we had rehearsed with a lot, but it was just the, by the process of doing the training, it was very simple. It was just like, boom, all we do is switch the aircraft. And this is the one that has the legs, but it's a different aircraft, but we know how to do it.
How much of, and maybe we'll kind of start to wrap the discussion up with this, but I don't think there's any way of describing this other than as wildly successful from an operational perspective, this particular action. That's not always going to be the case. That is certainly isn't always the case on every operation that we launch. You know, how much of that is I guess a better way of asking it is how much of that was because we did everything right, and how much of that was just there's some luck involved too?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth noting most people can't imagine the degree of planning that does go on. And something that I preach to my business clients, I own a consulting firm, and that they don't do, and that's contingency planning. You've got to assume that it's not going to go right. And so it isn't just, you know, determine what the mission's going to be, you know, assign responsibility, plan it, brief it, rehearse it, execute it. It's no. Now, what are the things that could go wrong that we're going to have an absolute, you know, nightmare if it happens? And then let's just assume it's going to happen. We're going to crash an airplane going to get bin Laden on the objective. How are we going to exfil those guys? Where are they going to sit? How are we going to get them out? How long is it going to take us? So I think the people probably can't even begin to imagine the depth of planning that goes on, not just for the mission itself, but the contingency planning for what if, because you got to assume that those things are going to happen. In this case, it didn't. And they were fortunate. And yeah, there's luck involved. I mean, you just said it, you know, a few drones could have got launched and suddenly we got an aircraft down, and it doesn't usually go down where you want it to. It goes down somewhere really bad. Look at Mogadishu. And now we've got, okay, a crisis in multiple locations. We're trying to do actions on the objective. We got an aircraft down. We got to do, you know, launch the QRF. We got to recover that thing. I mean, you got to assume that those things are going to happen, and you got to have a plan for it.
Yeah, I think it's both, as Jimmy said. And, you know, for me, anytime I was on the way to a target finding an aircraft, I never thought about once what I had to do on the objective, because I had done that dozens or hundreds of times. My entire time driving or flying there, all I could think about was every possible thing that could go wrong. That was going through my head. That way, if it happened, if something went wrong, it would never be the one that you thought of. but just a process of going through it, you would be ready to react. But also a little bit of luck, right? I mean, Mogadishu, I mean, for those that, you know, that know the story, right? It was just one ranger falling or missing a fast rope, right? If that hadn't happened, they would have been in and out, and there wouldn't have been a movie and a book or anything, right? I mean, so one little thing, and maybe the contingency planning wasn't as good then, and they didn't have some assets they should have had. But like one little thing like that can just turn everything. So without a doubt, it's, you know, but you influence your own luck, right? I mean, luck is a matter of many things, but by having good contingency planning and a well-trained force, you create your own luck and minimize the likelihood of having bad things happen. You don't totally mitigate them, but you minimize it.
What role does the sort of after action review process play after something like this?
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy will probably tell you, they're going back there and they're telling you how everything went wrong. I mean, right, when you're going back there, you're not patting each other on the back. You're pointing out the flaw, you know, you're admitting, you're volunteering things that you could have done better, or things that didn't go that we got lucky on, right?
I used to say all the time, we'll scratch a scab until it bleeds, right? It ought to hurt. And I preach this with business all the time. You know, they don't do it enough. They only do it if something goes catastrophically wrong. And so, yeah, it's a matter of, as good as it looked to us, I'll guarantee you they came up with 100 things that they could have done better, should have done better. You know, just that's how performing organizations get better and better and better, because they will scratch a scab until it bleeds.
Right. I mean, if you didn't go on the operation and you just, you know, didn't hear what the operation was and just walked into the after action review they were conducting, you would have thought the operation was probably a failure, because that's how they are.
Is that typical across the board, do you think, in these cases?
In good organizations, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like, but that's how it is in the special operation. I mean, when we did our first raid in Afghanistan, it was brutal. It was brutal.
Yeah. I would imagine that you could, you know, if you were privy to all of this information, you could draw a pretty quick through line from that first operation, those first operations in Afghanistan, all the way through the bin Laden raid, which was informed by lessons learned from previous after action reviews. And that, you know, this operation, I'm sure, has, you know, the fingerprints of Neptune's spear on it because of the things that went right and the things that went wrong to constantly sort of improve and refine the TTPs of everything, of everybody involved.
For sure.
Without a doubt.
Well, thank you both for joining me. I think we'll leave it there. We could probably have a much longer discussion. I'm sure there are very interesting discussions happening in SCIFs all over where they've got more information. But I appreciate you both coming on and sharing your sort of experience-driven perspectives on this.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks again.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.